This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Oren Starn is chair of the anthropology department at Duke. And you might say his studies began as a young man when his family moved to Florence, Italy. That's when Oren learned about Catholicism, cigarettes, and girls. At first, of course, he just experienced those things, but it wasn't long before he was reflecting on their deeper significance. And that's the stuff of cultural anthropology. Not that he acted like a scholar. In fact, Oren did about everything he could to avoid getting a university education, including dropping out of two different colleges in the 70s before wandering onto a Native American reservation and working as a janitor and a cook. Eventually, though, he did go back to school, and when he graduated, he hit what he called the Gringo Trail, traveled around South America with his backpack. His increasing consciousness about social injustice in South America led him to get his PhD in anthropology. He's since turned his anthropologist's eye on political unrest in the Andes, Native American issues in the U.S., and his newest book is called The Passion of Tiger Woods, an anthropologist reports on golf, race, and celebrity scandal. Oren Starn joins me in the studio today. Welcome back to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Let's start right away with golf. What attracted you to this game as an anthropologist?
I played golf as a kid. My grandfather took me out to the course for the first time when I was 11 or 12, and I liked it. But I was also into other sports, and I played basketball and soccer, real sports where you actually have to jump and run and do athletic things. But a sad thing happens as we get older, and especially over 40, our body doesn't want to play those real sports so much anymore. And I decided to go back to playing golf. There's actually a reason that you see all these older people out at the golf course. It's easy on the body. You can drive your little golf cart and have 4 hours out with your friends and get a little exercise in the bargain.
You know that you've just filled up our email inbox now when you said that golf is not a real sport.
Well, actually,
I'm forwarding them all to you, Oren.
Part of the attraction of golf is actually it's a lot harder than you might think. It doesn't look very athletic when you're watching sometimes overweight professional golfers on TV. But many people are surprised when they go out to the driving range for the first time and try to hit a golf ball and find that they can't hit the ball at all or only advance it a couple of inches. Golf's really different from, say, bowling. In that sense. And anybody can go to the bowling alley and get an occasional strike. But golf actually does require some coordination to play.
Now, we set this up and talked about you getting into anthropology. Your entree really was recognition of social injustice in South America and then sort of how do these societies form and what do we do about it and all that. Now, when you think about golf, it's got a kind of country club image, and I wonder if that doesn't sort of work against the sort of ethos, the aesthetic of your career.
Well, golf does have this terrible public image, especially it's among a certain left-leaning, Whole Foods shopping, yoga practicing, NPR listening set. Golf doesn't have the greatest of profiles. A friend of mine calls golf a tragic waste of real estate. And many people will say, well, I can understand how you'll go out and play golf and you get a little exercise. What really horrifies them is the idea of watching golf on TV.
Yeah.
It seems incredibly boring and slow. George Carlin, the comedian, once said that he'd rather watch flies copulating than a golf tournament. And copulating wasn't exactly the word that he used. But,
yeah.
You know, this is a family radio program. But I've actually found that, you know, in writing about golf, that golf says a lot about America. And there's a lot. Golf is the end point of the American dream, in a certain version of the American dream, this idea of retiring and heading to Scottsdale or to Florida and having that condo on the 17th hole of a golf course. So I found golf very much wrapped up in America and all its contradictions and pleasures and strangenesses.
Well, and the fact that it's a highly individual sport, it certainly is not a team sport.
No, and golf is traditionally has been the sport of power of politicians. Every American president since William Howard Taft has been a golfer, except Jimmy Carter, and that includes Barack Obama, who's been criticized for sneaking off to the golf course too often. And golf has also been the official sport, or the unofficial sport, of American capitalism. So everybody from Bill Gates to Warren Buffett plays. And I think it's, there are many different reasons for that, but partly because golf isn't an individual game. It's all about scorekeeping and about keeping track of numbers, and it fits with a certain kind of business spirit. Plus, you can hang out with your for 4 or 5 hours with the guy that you're trying to make a sale to. In fact, at Duke Law School now, they're offering a course in golf with the idea that this is really a key bit of sports literacy for future corporate lawyers and other people going into business.
Plus, you can cheat, lie, and gamble, which is a kind of an all-American business sport.
It's got it all.
Now, Tiger Woods does change the equation. I mean, it's not just golf anymore. He is arguably at the peak of his career, perhaps the best golfer who ever played.
Tiger's is golf's first crossover star. I remember my grandmother, who's since passed away, who's in her 90s and not really interested in golf at all, but she'd tune in when Tiger was playing in a golf tournament. He really had, I think still has, a charisma and of ability that makes for must-see TV, at least for people who have some interest in sports at all. So he did change the equation. There have been famous golfers. Arnold Palmer also had his own following, Jack Nicklaus, but for a whole bunch of different reasons, Tiger became a real American phenomenon.
And he did so at a very early age.
So right now, I'd like you to meet Tiger Woods and his father, Earl Woods. Would you come?
That was Mike Douglas introducing him at the age. Now, he said in that thing, and you can see this on YouTube, he said he was 2 years old. That's just a lie, isn't it? He wouldn't do it.
He's indeed two, and that clip is at least if you're interested in golf, is worth YouTubing. This two-year-old boy marches onto the set of the Mike Douglas show and begins whacking golf balls into this driving range net on the show. And Tiger was, among many other things, a child prodigy. I mean, it's 2-year-olds. Are not supposed to be able to play golf. And yet Tiger was like Mozart in a way, or at least in that class of genius like Mozart, albeit in very different fields, in the sense that he was a child prodigy who was just as good or even better when he grew up. He wasn't one of those child prodigies who burned out and at an early age.
Well, and that television appearance was shocking in a way, startling for a few reasons. A 2-year-old boy smacking golf balls and doing a pretty good job. An African-American father, he looked for like an African-American young boy playing a sport that had been purely associated with white folks. There was Bob Hope and Jimmy Stewart standing there looking on with wonder and awe.
I think part of the drama attached to Tiger's story was the idea of this young black superstar in a traditionally white sport. And golf has a very checkered history around race. There were country clubs that as late as the late 1980s and early 1990s that still banned African Americans. There's also a history of anti-Semitism in some of the early country clubs. So the idea that this young black kid was beginning to dominate in a white sport caught people's attention. And yes, you wouldn't if your listeners are interested and watch that YouTube clip, they'll see Bob Hope and Jimmy Stewart, these two American icons, helping to co-host the show that day and watching Little Tiger. And I think neither of them could have imagined that what they were watching was not some kind of sideshow novelty act, but was a passing of the figurative superstar baton from those two men who were such important figures in American popular culture in the 50s and 60s to the man who would become one of the world's most famous Americans, for better or worse, in the late 20th century.
And as you point out in your book, this also, his career, Tiger Woods' career and his persona, pointed out some of the contradictions. He was the embodiment of this American fantasy of a post-racial America at the peak of his career.
Yeah, I mean, I've been interested by the parallels and the differences between Tiger and Barack Obama in thinking about this question of race and American culture. There are some uncanny parallels in their biographies. Both of them are the children of these global mixed marriages. Tiger's mom was Thai and his dad was African American. They met in Thailand in the era of the Vietnam War. Both of them went to elite private California colleges, Occidental in Obama's case and Stanford in Tiger's case. And both became these great superstars, larger-than-life figures in traditionally white-dominated fields, golf and politics. So there are these parallels between Obama and Woods. And Obama's also a big golfer, as I mentioned earlier. But there are also these very revealing, I think, differences. One of them at the family level is that Obama grows up mostly without his father, whereas Tiger has this stage dad supreme, Earl Woods. But also there are real differences in the way that the two men have sought to navigate American racial politics. Obama has for the most part stayed within the traditional lexicon of American race, in the sense that he's defined himself as he calls himself a black man of mixed heritage, whereas Tiger has much more embraced this idea of multiracialism, the idea that he's black but also Asian, Native American, Caucasian. He's called himself Kablan Asian as a fusion of those of the different ancestries that he claims.
Talking with Oren Starn, chair of the anthropology department at Duke University, author of the new book, The Passion of Tiger Woods. And our conversation continues after a short break on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking with Oren Starn, chair of the anthropology department at Duke University, author of the new book, The Passion of Tiger Woods. And we're talking about Tiger as this image of the new post-racial America. And then the minute the sex scandal hits, his image immediately is used in that other, more familiar way.
So Tiger really comes to seem in the first few years of the 21st century, as you say, this icon of an America that's transcended its old racial division. So he's married to a blue-eyed, blonde-haired Swedish woman. They have these adorable mixed-race kids. They have two dogs, like every good American family. But race and race seems to be no longer a part of the equation in the way that people are thinking about Tiger. He's become such a great celebrity, such a famous figure, that he seems to have got beyond the messy muck of American racial politics. But what happens when the scandal breaks in at the end of 2009 is that Tiger gets re-racialized, gets racially coded in a whole different way, and perhaps predictably gets coded as the stereotypical oversexed, hypersexualized black man. You don't see any of this nasty recoding of Tiger's racial identity in the National Enquirer or on radio programs or on TV. Where you see it is on the internet, on these back channel message boards, in the posts, in this whole underground of American racial commentary that seizes upon this idea that, well, after all, Tiger Woods is just another black man.
Yeah, but the cover of Vanity Fair, I think, is not a blog, and it is pretty mainstream. And that was a deliberate. And there was this hyper-sexualized, you know, black male on the cover in the form of Tiger Woods.
Yeah, this is a picture taken by the famous photographer Annie Leibovitz. And yes, it literally, the cover literally blackens Tiger in the way that it's the way that it's shot and its tones. And yes, this process is going on, and it's something that we've seen before and continue to see in the way that Americans think about often African-American celebrities. We saw it with O.J. O.J. had way back in the 70s and 80s had achieved or come to this status as a sort of honorary white man where he was de-blackened. And yet after the crimes that were committed and he gets into the doghouse of American public opinion, he's re-racialized in all of these different ways as a black man after all. There's this very peculiar quality that racial identity can have in the United States, the way that people can get racialized in one way and then racialized in another. And that's very much happened with Tiger. One of the questions about him is, what race will Tiger be next year? If he has a wonderful comeback year and wins all these tournaments, is he going to be viewed through this post-racial lens all over again? It's hard to say.
Well, let's talk about this. Will he be viewed through these lenses? Whose lenses? If you assume that this is a complex nation with a lot of different ideas about race and Tiger Woods, all current, all buzzing on the internet at the same time, and yet the picture on Vanity Fair, the way the New York Times characterizes this, the way Golf Digest is going to characterize it, do become kind of dominant images, and they change. What drives that? Why are we so interested in this guy? And what is it that drives the change? Is it the media pulling us, or is there some sort of mass change of view about this fellow?
Well, I think in terms of racial identity, it's important to keep in mind the broader context of race and in American culture. And after the civil rights movement, the terms of discourse about race really shift. There's a whole set of words and slurs and stereotypes that can't be voiced in public anymore, at least without getting you into trouble. So as people like Don Imus, Al Campanis, and many others have found, if you say these certain words or express these ugly, hateful stereotypes, you're going to get in big trouble. And that's a difference from the pre-civil rights era. So it would be possible to imagine, and I often wonder if a space alien landed in the United States and just started watching the TV news programs and reading the newspapers, whether they might imagine that race in America was fixed. After all, there seems to be an African-American and a couple white guys in every beer commercial, every college admission brochure has a person of each different heritage on it. But what's happened, I think, in American society is a lot of that ugliness about race has been driven underground into these off-channel settings of the internet, of the private conversation between friends. I personally think we've made progress around race in America, but it would be wrong, I think, to imagine that this whole repertoire of stereotypes and misrepresentations, racial animosity, paranoia, anxiety, and fantasy aren't still very much out there, because they are, and they were really triggered by Tiger and his problems.
And they become dominant, and they make their way to the front pages and to the covers. What do you think is happening there, and why is this kind of story? Why are we so fascinated by, of all things, a sex scandal?
Well, Americans, we have this very peculiar relationship to our celebrities. We want to be like celebrities. We want to be celebrities. I think one of the things that's been said about Facebook, it's a way for each of us to be a celebrity, where we give these status updates about what's going on in our relationships, where these paparazzi photos are posted, where we are able to magnify our image onto the internet. So I think we have celebrity envy, but at the same time, we're really eager to tear celebrities up when they get into trouble, to make them into these ritual scapegoats. And this idea of the celebrity as this person who can be sacrificed, who can be publicly stoned, who can be all of these negative things and snarky things can be said about them, is part of American mass media and mass culture and mass psychology, I'd say, right now.
In The Passion of Tiger Woods, you talk about an anthropologist, Victor Turner, and his idea of the social drama.
Turner is one of these old style anthropologists from the 60s who's a bit out of fashion and seems maybe not current enough. But yes, he had this model of the social drama, which I won't bore your listeners by recapitulating. But part of the idea of the social drama is the idea that at a certain point after there's trouble or conflict, that the person who the conflict and trouble centers around needs to make what Turner called some kind of redressive action. He or she needs to try to do something to make things right and to get reintegrated into society. And so celebrity scandals are social dramas. And one of the redressive actions that's become this ritualized kabuki theater is the apology. So the celebrity does something wrong, gets into trouble, and is forced to comes forward to give this apology on, it used to be on Oprah, but on Barbara Walters or in the newspapers or on 60 Minutes, with this idea that this will be their means to reintegrate themselves into American society and into the good graces of the public. We've seen it with Bill Clinton. We've seen it with Tiger Woods. We've seen it with literally dozens of celebrities. We're a culture of apology right now.
Well, what does that say about us? I mean, obviously, it's complex, and you could say a lot, but what are some of the broad conclusions you could draw from this particular scandal about who we are as a nation, loving this particular drama played out in the way it was?
Well, I think the whole drama of celebrity scandal is a weird, it can be an entertaining one, but it's also weird and twisted and doesn't say very good things about us. And Tiger Woods did something, have a bunch of extramarital affairs that was not a good thing, but is also something that, you know, millions of Americans have also done. And yet your average Durhamite does not find themselves on the cover of National Enquirer or the New York Times because of what's been going on in their sex life. So, and with celebrities, there's this special set of expectations, this special pleasure, I think, that both the media and sometimes the public take in ferociously, you know, crucifying celebrities and making them run through this gauntlet of opprobrium, and then they're expected to come forward with the apology and usually can get rehabilitated once they make that apology.
What is it about sex, though, in this country? I'm thinking about Herman Cain at the moment. Here's a guy who has said so many inane, crazy, impolitic things that utterly disqualify him as a candidate for office. And it's a sex scandal that brings him down. Really? It was infidelity and not all the crazy things he said?
Well, I think Americans are schizophrenic and wacky about sex in general. On the one hand, we have this Puritan streak that runs through American culture and the idea of monogamy, the idea of that we don't want our presidents to have extramarital affairs, which is something that doesn't seem very strange at all to the French or to people in Europe. So on the one hand, we have this Puritan tradition. But on the other hand, we live in this sex-saturated culture where Victoria's Secret and using sex to sell television shows and movies, where Hooters, where pornography, which just occupies so much space on the internet, are all very much part of the American zeitgeist. So I think there is this strange doubleness in the way that about the place that sex occupies in American culture.
And what about sports in American culture in general?
Sports in American culture, sports have become, especially in the last 30 or 40 years with the growth of TV, cable TV, and now the internet, sports have become a gigantic part of global business, culture, and imagination. And certainly America leads the way in all of this. I think it's possible to argue that there's never been such a sports-crazy, sports-saturated culture in the history of the world as the United States. There's one social theorist who talks about sports glut USA. So now we have ESPN and many other channels that give us sports broadcasts 24/7. We have fantasy football. We have much of the weekend energy of the media was taken up by the NFL playoffs. Tonight we'll have the college football championship game. We're a society that's crazy about sports for better and sometimes I often think for worse.
Do we love it for the sport? To what extent do you think the, because people complain about the amount of money, it's become an industry, it's all about the money, and yet I wonder if the money isn't part of the glamour and part of what attracts us to the game.
Well, I'm of two minds about this because on the one hand, I think that sports can be an incredibly beautiful and aesthetically wonderful thing. I went to a Duke basketball game a few nights ago, and it's really like going to the Metropolitan Opera or the Bolshoi Ballet to go to Cameron and to see these astonishingly skilled athletes doing this thing under the tutelage of a legendary maestro. So there is much that's appealing about sports, these moments of pleasure and beauty and drama in sports. But there's also something prosaic and predictable and time-wasting about sports. And I think it would be pretty easy to argue that Americans spend too much of their time thinking about sports and not thinking about things like global warming, poverty and injustice, or spending enough time with their family.
Although you've also said that these spectacles that do distract us, whether they're sex scandals or sports, that the argument that they are a distraction is in a sense part of the theater around the scandal itself or the distraction.
Well, exactly. If you track the message boards around the Tiger Woods scandal, I looked some at, for example, at the message board of the Washington Post, and you have people weighing in saying, and this is the way that many people felt, this is awful and a disgrace and abomination that you're spending so much time on the sexual life of a sports star, and why do you spend so much on sports coverage in the first place, and why don't we have more stories on Afghanistan and on other real life problems? But of course, there's the paradox that at once people want to say, hey, why are you spending so much time on this? But they're weighing in and becoming and playing their own role in the theater. It reminds me a bit of the sort of predictable post in the New York Times about Sarah Palin. Every time there's a story about Sarah Palin in the New York Times, there are 40, 50 people on the comment board saying, why do you spend so much time on Sarah Palin? She doesn't deserve time and attention. Sarah Palin, I'm so sick of her, and end up magnifying the whole phenomenon in the first place.
Now, a second ago, you were talking about Duke basketball, referring to Krzyzewski as maestro. You compared it to the Bolshoi, the Metropolitan Opera. But you have also been critical about the way Duke and other universities manage sports and the way they've taken over their role, I guess, or the part they play in the culture of college life.
Yeah, well, sports occupy a very strange place in the American university, a gigantic place. And we now have our colleges and universities running what is in effect, and I think undeniably, a billion-dollar sports entertainment complex. So we have college athletes becoming these celebrities, coaches earning these million-dollar salaries. And it's a very strange idea in the sense that one was always taught to believe that that colleges were supposed to be about intellectual growth, educational experience, a range of different extracurricular activities. And yet in our universities, and we're the only country in the world that does it this way, Oxford and Cambridge don't have semi-professional money earning on TV all the time, soccer teams, for example. But that's what we do in the United States. And I think it's easy to see the appeal of college sports. They're dramatic. They're a wonderful spectacle. They bring together these plot lines. On the other hand, I think there's something sick about the idea that colleges and universities are spending so much of their resources, so much of their energy on sports.
Well, is that part of this paradox of the American fantasy? Again, the belief that, no, we can have this pristine college, this sport, the sons, men's, and a son's corpus. We're going to have – and we're going to develop the whole individual here, and that's what college is all about, versus Europe, where we'd say, look, it's a business. We're going to let the young athletes go off and be in the semi-pro league, and the rest of you go to college. Here we think we can have it all, I guess.
We think we can have it all, but I teach at Duke, and the first thing that happens on the first day of class, when I just taught a big lecture class on the anthropology of sports, and I had 70 or 80 kids who play on different Duke teams in the class. And on the first day of class, the student athletes come to the professor, they come to me, and they give me these forms that list all of the classes, my classes, that they're going to miss that semester because they're going to be traveling to different basketball or lacrosse or women's golf tournaments. And don't get me wrong, I love student athletes at Duke. I mean, I'm full of admiration and awe for the way that these kids are able to spend 20, sometimes 30, 40 hours a week on their sport and still be good students. I mean, it's an amazing kind of discipline. But yet, you know, as a professor, I also wonder about sports and how big they've become and how it's become and almost taken for granted that I'm supposed to let these kids miss five or six of my classes during the semester because the higher mission of college sports calls.
Well, are they getting it all? Are they extraordinary in the sense that they're getting a full education, or are they simply missing something? They're not getting a complete education.
Well, the Chronicle Higher Education recently did a study that shows that the average Division I college athlete, and this is just not just in basketball or football, but in the other sports, lacrosse, field hockey, and so forth, spend 41 hours a week on their sport. So in effect, these students who are athletes at Duke, at UNC, at NC State already have a full-time job when they're in college, and that full-time job is called being an athlete. Now, because most of these kids are disciplined and dedicated and hardworking, they're able to get a decent education to go to classes and to get their work done if they work really, really hard. What they miss almost entirely is the wider range of college experience, of things like writing for the school paper, study abroad, volunteer work, although some athletes do that impressively, the arts. I do think that they get that student athletes get a limited version of the college experience.
My guest is Oren Starn, teaches anthropology at Duke University, and his new book is called The Passion of Tiger Woods. We'll talk about that and how he came to be an anthropologist after traipsing around South America when our conversation continues. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Oren Starn, chair of the anthropology department at Duke and the author of the new book, The Passion of Tiger Woods. So let's talk a little bit about how you came to be an anthropologist.
Well, I'm actually a big booster of anthropology as a discipline and as a career now, although it's a tough job market. In the old days, anthropology used to be the study of the so-called other, and these famous figures like Margaret Mead would journey off to study so-called primitive peoples in the far corners of the world, in Samoa and in Africa and the Amazon jungle. But in the 60s and 70s, this change began in anthropology, and anthropologists started to realize that if they were really to be about the study of culture, and that's what anthropology is supposed to be, the study of culture, the study of how people live, their traditions, their beliefs, then they ought to be doing that everywhere and studying culture, whether in a white suburban neighborhood in the U.S. or in a corporate boardroom on Wall Street or in the South African stock market. And so now anthropology is really a discipline where you have people working on an astonishingly broad range of different contemporary topics. So in my department at Duke, we have somebody working on the stock market in South Africa. I have a colleague who just published a book a couple of years ago about Pokemon and Mighty Morphin Power Rangers and a kid's culture in Japan. And then yet you still have anthropologists who are working in these more traditional, out-of-the-way places in West Africa, in Tibet, in the Andes, as I did when I was younger. So it's really quite an exciting time in anthropology in the sense that if you want to become an anthropologist, you can study just about anything that you think matters.
In thinking about the way anthropology has changed, and you made reference to those iconic figures going to exotic places and studying culture, have we also changed the idea about what a culture is, that it's not monolithic anymore, that these people don't have a culture, but it's a much more subtle and complex thing?
Exactly. Well, one of the problems in that older anthropology, which had many virtues as well, was a very monolithic idea of culture. So, for example, Margaret Mead had an idea and depicted Samoa as a place where everybody there, man, woman, kid, believed in Samoan culture and followed the supposed principles of Samoan culture. When, you know, in fact, we know that everywhere people disagree and have different versions of how we ought to behave. And we also know that things are changing and that the rules that we live by are never exactly fixed. And we also know now more, I think, are more aware than ever before of the way that the world is profoundly globalized and interconnected. So cultures are not these different separate things, Indian culture, Chinese culture, American culture, but rather these much more flexible assemblages where there's all kinds of hybridization and borrowing and back and forth. And part of the challenge for anthropologists is trying to understand these dynamics of how culture and politics and history work in this very complex world.
You came to this because of a trip to South America?
I'm 51 years old, and I in the 70s, the late 70s, when I went to college and early 80s, anthropology was only just then changing, and there was still this idea that to be a real anthropologist, you had to go somewhere exotic sounding, like high in the Andes in Peru or into the rainforest in West Africa. And so I, in fact, ended up going to South America and living for several years in a village in Peru, partly because I found, perhaps in a very predictable way for a young American man, I found the Andes, this larger-than-life, outsized place with these gigantic mountains and this astonishing history. But also because this is the 80s, it was the Reagan era, there was a lot of campus activism and I had this image of Latin America as a place where exciting stuff was happening politically, the land of Che Guevara and the Sandinistas. And it was partly this idea of Latin America that very much drew me there back in those times.
And, of course, in Peru, there was the Shining Path.
Well, being in Peru in the 80s was something of an education in the way that Marxism could go horribly astray. And you have to remember in the 80s, this is before perestroika and the fall of the wall. It's when Deng Xiaoping is just taking power. And I think there was a tendency back then on the political left to assume that, well, you know, probably Stalin did some bad things and maybe the Cultural Revolution was not a great idea. But in the great cosmic political balance, most bad, awful, evil, violent things have been done with the backing of capitalism and the United States, and that Marxist governments and projects were not quite so sinister. But when I went to Peru and saw the Shining Path, this very doctrinaire Maoist group, and saw the kind of violence that they employed, often against the very poorest Peruvians, it really forced me to rethink some of the probably overly simplistic ideas I had about revolution and the ways that great dreams, great socialist dreams, can lead into pretty awful political ideologies.
Well,
and practices.
It makes me think too, and I'd love to know what you think about this sort of the commodification of an image like Che, for instance, that picture that now can mean anything to anybody.
Yeah, I was just in Cuba about a month ago, and it's something of a time warp because you see, Cuba isn't open to multinational business, or at least American multinational business. So there's no commercials on TV, there are no billboards, they're not the dross of American commercialism that we're so familiar with. But what you do see everywhere in Cuba is billboards with Che and sayings of Che, and that iconic photograph of Che that was taken by Alberto Korda, who was something of the court photographer for the early Cuban Revolution. And I don't know I think some college students may still have those Che Guevara posters up on their wall, but certainly many of us did back on the
Well,
the
and it's
early
making
80s.
A comeback, and you can see those T-shirts now everywhere, and they can represent anything, and I think they can sell toothpaste these days.
That's well, there certainly is. I mean, much ink has been spilled about the psychology and habits of the contemporary American college student. In fact, I have a daughter who's a freshman now in the University of Pennsylvania. But there certainly is, among other things, a strain of idealism among college students now. There are many kids who are interested in volunteering and in trying to make the world a better place. And certainly Che and this, the idea that you would sacrifice your life for to make things better for the poor, he's a figure and an icon that one can imagine still be appealing to a certain segment of college students.
And yet he was certainly responsible for murders and purges and all sorts of other things. But this is actually going to lead to another part of the conversation, and that is how we come to appropriate these icons to mean one thing or another. We watched Tiger Woods go from post-racialism to a hyper-sexualized African-American male because of his scandal. You were an outspoken during the Duke lacrosse story and talking about the culture of sports and what it was doing to the campus of Duke. It was hard to have that nuanced conversation because you never at any point said, you know, let's throw these kids out. Let's not bother to try them. You were in fact, you were critical of Mike Nifong all the way through. And yet the conversation, the deep conversation about the culture of sports and its impact on students and the campus couldn't be had because it was about either defending these kids or criticizing them. And there was no kind of in between, no more nuanced conversation that could be had.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to I would say that not much good came out of the Duke lacrosse case. I think a lot of people didn't behave in a way that was I think it brought out the worst in a lot of us, and I think it also wasted a couple of years of the life of the university because the Duke's president and PR machine were spending much of their energy trying to keep Duke's public profile from getting destroyed by the scandal. So yeah, the Duke lacrosse case I think it became a shouting match. It got really nasty and ugly, and I'm not sure what good exactly came out of it. But I do think that there are still questions about college sports and its role in our universities that have remained unanswered. And if you, these are very, the Duke lacrosse case was a story all on its own. But if you look this year, there have been these gigantic scandals in college sports. Just down the road at Chapel Hill, we had made-up grades and made-up independent studies and charges that tutors were writing papers for football players. We had a gigantic scandal at the Miami Hurricanes football team involving a booster buying prostitutes and Caribbean cruises for recruits. We have the Penn State scandal, which makes the Duke lacrosse case look like peanuts in terms of the publicity and the awful things that appear to have been involved up there. So certainly the question of college sports and scandal is one that we probably ought to still be talking about.
And we're not. And it gets me back to Victor Turner's idea of the social drama. You would think that the social drama would have the effect of clearing the air, of moving forward, of dealing with the crisis and leading to some kind of change. But now we seem to be generating crisis for its own sake, scandal for its own sake. The drama never really seems to end in improvement. What do you think? Or is this just my imagination? Are we just in the middle of it? Give it 10 years and we'll see how things go.
Well, I'd say with college sports, it's striking how on the one hand you've had this unending, it seems like often, series of scandals. And yet, so on the one hand, you might think that that would have given big-time college sports a black eye. But quite the contrary, more people are watching college sports than ever before. The jerseys are selling. The Duke basketball brand is bigger than ever. So there is this paradox of the string of scandals as against what seems to be our great enchantment with college sports as a nation. And more broadly, I think in terms of celebrity scandals and the Tiger Woodses and the Lindsay Lohans of the world, I think part of the appeal of them is that each one, they're all the same in the sense that they involve some kind of transgression, the vilification of the celebrity, all of this different cacophony on the web and among commentators. They're all the same. Usually it ends in the – or that we have the apology made by the celebrity. In Tiger's case, the news channels, that ABC and some of the other networks, actually cut away from their regular broadcasting to show Tiger's apology live, as if they were announcing the assassination of a president or something. But so there's something very predictable about celebrity scandal. But each one is different, too, and involves this different alchemy of factors like – race and drugs and age and gender and sexuality. So they're dramas, and
but do
dramas
they perform, can be interesting. Can be interesting, but do they perform a role? Did they ever have a function? And have we become unhinged from that function of social drama, and it's just been for its own sake? Or has it always been that way, that the drama is just for our entertainment? I mean, has it ever performed a role in the society of actually leading to change, reform?
No, I don't think. I mean, I think scandal entertains us and diverts us. I think it seldom leads into reform. Certainly, celebrity scandal and the Tiger Woods scandal doesn't seem to lead into any grand social changes. But I do think that this idea of ritual scapegoating, which was introduced by this French theorist René Girard, and he has this idea that societies need to sacrifice people in order to feel good about themselves, in order to make themselves pure. And so you could see this dynamic of the choosing of the ritual scapegoat often involving choosing the weak in society. So the Jews, the migrant, the old person, the person who's in this structurally weak kind of positioning. And that's often the way that ritual scapegoating functions and still functions, including the United States, I'd say, with migrants. But in the United States, we've added this different twist. We scapegoat and sacrifice. We offer up to the gods these people who are the most powerful and famous and wealthy among us.
Well, and that gets to one of Girard's other theories about the mimetic, the fact that we imitate others, and that's how we get our – that's how we obtain our identity. And there's something about this inimitability of the superhero and wanting to bring them down to size that makes it equally or more attractive.
Yeah, there's something – it's a funny psychology, this desire, this admiration and glory and money and attention that we give to the Tiger Woodses of the world, and yet also this envy and this readiness to turn upon them when they seem to have strayed from our expectations.
You know, I have left myself very little time, and I wanted to talk with you about this notion of the other that anthropology has always been engaged with. And I wonder if we're in a world now where we've lost that sense. I mean, are there others, other exotic cultures out there that we don't know about, or are there others left to study?
Well, I think the reality of the world in 2012 is that there aren't any mountain peaks that haven't been climbed, or any wild rivers that haven't been run, or any so-called primitive peoples that haven't yet been discovered. You know, we live in a small world now, one in which there really isn't any place or space outside and unto itself. But we certainly want to imagine, I think we have this thirst to imagine that there are these spaces of otherness, that there are somewhere out there hiding in the Amazon jungle, this uncontacted, or maybe in the jungles of New Guinea, this uncontacted tribe, this group of people that will teach us about some forgotten ancestral life way. But it's a fantasy that I think we still like to indulge in.
Plus, we could spend the rest of our lives just trying to figure ourselves out. So it doesn't
exactly.
seem to be
There's
worth
a lot
the
of work to be done there.
Oren, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Oren Starn, chair of the anthropology department and professor of cultural anthropology at Duke. His newest book called The Passion of Tiger Woods, an anthropologist reports on golf, race, and celebrity scandal. Going to read from that book tonight at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, 7 o'clock. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. If you want to comment on the show or hear an archived edition, go to the website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Alex Granados and Jessica Fuller. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor, Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.